This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Military force is typically the bedrock of a nation's power. In this complex and dynamic world of changing demands, the nature of security today requires that it be conceived more broadly than ever before. Some have called for a new, vibrant strategic direction for U.S. national security and foreign policy. Today's context presents a unique set of challenges and requires a new way of thinking about American power, security, and leadership. For the United States to be an effective world leader, how does it strategically balance all three aspects of its power, defense, diplomacy, and development? What are the strategic threats facing the U.S. today? And how can the use of smart power address some of these complex global problems? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command, and author most recently of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. General Zinni, welcome to the program. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Frank Strickland. Frank, welcome.
Thank you.
General Zinni, we need to understand power and how it's changing in the 21st century. Would you outline the dimensions and aspects of power that mark world politics in the 21st century?
Well, I think we have to understand how much the world has changed in the last two decades, beginning with the fall of the Soviet Union. We live in a very different world for a number of reasons. It's much more interdependent. I think globalization, the rise of information technology, the migrations of people have caused this. There's been power shifts. There's probably more balance of power in the world. I think we've learned today that military power no longer has the clout that maybe it once did. Right now, I think economic power, social influence, political influence, those dimensions of power may be greater or at least as great as the projection of force around the world. And I think we as a nation, the United States, have to learn how to use that, how to integrate all the elements of power more effectively in this world. And I think we haven't mastered it yet. I think we have a long way to go to understand that. I was impressed with the Obama national security strategy that came out last May because it identified the foundation of our national security as education, the economy, and our energy dependence, that these were areas we had to work on. What was impressive about that is that it was an acknowledgement that it isn't just projection of influence or power in a military sense. It was looking internally at the foundations of our own system that need to be strengthened in this different environment. So I think in that respect, it's been a major change.
General Zinni, after 1989, you point out that the peace dividend went the way of Checkpoint Charlie and the Berlin Wall. The New World Order turned into the New World Disorder. Would you elaborate on this perspective? And more importantly, what opportunities were missed?
I think there was a misbelief at the time that the world would self-order. I understand there could be good reason for that. I think President Bush, H.W. Bush, Gorbachev, other leaders of the world really believe that, you know, after coming so close to rendering our planet a cinder, you know, with the nuclear power that we had, the East versus West tensions for over half a century, I think people believe that there would be such a sense of relief that we would now turn away from military spending, there would be a peace dividend, that there would be more of a self-ordering, the world would be more cooperative. There was a lot of hope that there would be regional and global integration of interests and coming together, more balance of power and wealth in the world. But none of that really materialized. And I think the big mistake was unlike at the end of World War II, where the United States and really provided the resources, the wherewithal, the strategic guidance to reshape the world in major ways, the Marshall Plan, the way we reconstructed our own government, the rise of development banks, and things that helped reshape a world in a new, different environment. It didn't happen. I was in European command at the time. And Secretary of State Baker, through Ambassador Rich Armitage, was trying to form a cooperative Marshall Plan for the former republics of the Soviet Union. And I actually was working for Ambassador Armitage at the time to do that. And what impressed me was the lack of interest in that, both in the United States and with our allies that we were trying to encourage to participate in that. It was kind of frustrating. I think that was an attempt to do something like what Marshall and others did at the end of World War II, to take a sort of a fresh strategic look at the world, see how the leading and developed nations could best influence the kinds of positive conditions that needed to develop. And since that didn't occur, it kind of self-ordered or self-disordered in ways that we realize today.
General Zinni, turning from those missed opportunities to today and looking forward, what are some of the key strategic threats facing the U.S. today?
Well, I think the threats are much more varied than they were before. I mean, obviously, in the period of the Cold War, even before that, we looked at nation states or coalitions of nation states that presented a military threat, and that was the sum total of what we saw as existential threats. Now they're far more varied. I think the greatest threats right now are economic, or things that destabilize us that aren't necessarily being projected by sovereign entities in any way. They're borderless, they're non-state entities, like extremist groups and others that may present the greatest physical threat. We also have challenges in terms of economic cooperation and competition. I think that we're seeing a lot of reordering in the world. Many historians may look back at this period and describe it as a key point in time where the Islamic world reordered in some fashion or changed or transformed. And we can see that going on now in the streets of Cairo and Damascus and other places. So what I would describe as the key strategic threats is just a whole series of things. And they come in the area of political, social, economic, and security threats. They're much more varied in that respect. When I was writing my last book, I had a friend of mine who said it was like sleeping with a cobra for 50 years. And you woke up and realized the cobra was dead, never bit you. And now the room was full of bees and they were stinging you. You know, no one sting could kill you, but the cumulative effect could be devastating. And I thought, I used that actually in my book, stole it from me, but he described it very well. So I think it isn't sort of these monolithic single threats. It's just a whole collection of them, and they span the spectrum from political, economic, social, and security.
General Zinni, under the Goldwater-Nichols Act, each administration is required to submit a national security strategy. And you alluded earlier to the Obama administration national security strategy. Would you elaborate on the importance of this strategy? What are the key components of a national security strategy, and to what extent do we in the U.S. need an overarching strategy to deal coherently with these problems that you've been talking about?
Well, the Goldwater-Nichols Act very correctly required the president to produce this in 150 days and then to every year after that at a specific time to renew it or revalidate it. And it was tied to the budget process. It was supposed to provide the guidance and the strategic structure to the budget decisions that went on in Congress. Very few presidents have ever delivered on time or bothered to update it. As a matter of fact, to my shock, very few people in government even read the National Security Strategy. So the budget process is sort of a backwards process. People begin to drill down, and obviously decisions are made on funding based on local politics, pet projects, special interests, and they're not based on a strategic design. And that was the attempt of the Goldwater-Nichols, to get a strategic design behind something. I can see this in defense. I mean, to the credit of Secretary Gates, Admiral Mullen, I think they're seriously trying to reduce the defense budget, recognizing the realities of our economic situation. But I see us cherry-picking programs, sort of cherry-picking roles and missions. I don't see us step back and say, let's erase the board and start with the strategic design. Let's define what our military should be for the 21st century, where it should be. I mean, why do we have troops in Germany and Japan and South Korea? Maybe there's good reason, but have they been revalidated since they were put there based on old strategies, Carter doctrines, Nixon doctrines, post-World War II or Cold War environments? You know, I don't think any of that's been done. So the component parts of a strategy, obviously, are to define our vision, you know, where we see our country going, our power and purpose in the world, our involvement. You have to define our strategic interests, our vital national interests. We have to define the partnerships and alliances that mean something to us today and how we intend to support them and participate. You have to define the threats and how you intend to deal with them. And there's no answer that fits all the threats that you face. Some you may contain and deter. Some you may deal with directly. But I don't see that happening. I even in the recent Obama national security strategy, as I said, I was impressed that we took a look at the foundational internal issues as a beginning, which I think is important. But we didn't go through the detail of all this. And I don't see, even if we did, that guidance is being taken seriously by everybody. I just look at this current involvement, you know, recently in Libya. How do we get thrust into it? What are our vital national interests? What is our objective, political objective? What are the military tasks that are going to lead to that? We sort of knee-jerked or backed in to this, in my view. And that's what happens when you don't have a strategy. And the most important part of a strategy is to establish priorities. You can't, in this day and age, be all things to all people and meet all needs. So what is the priority? And what are the hard choices you're willing to make? And I don't see that today. And I think that's what the Goldwater-Nichols Act wanted to achieve. We probably need a greater Goldwater-Nichols Act that allows for more integration of our agencies and departments and government. That's woefully inadequate. We find that out after every crisis. 9/11 Commission, the Homeland Security Commission, you know, complain about the lack of integration, and the fixes they recommend just add more bureaucracy, and I don't see that they really solve the problem. Goldwater-Nichols Act did for the military, I think, truly created the right kind of integration, but we have a failure to do it on a larger scale for government.
General Zinni, shifting the emphasis of U.S. foreign policy from one that relies heavily on military might to one that elevates the value of diplomacy development will take strong leadership, a decisive strategy, and ample resources to ensure its success. Would you elaborate on the specific organizational and operational changes required for the U.S. to be successful in this area? And how does your Civilian Affairs Command concept factor into this process?
I think that this has become a significant issue. We can no longer resolve everything with just the military. The military, I think, is the first to realize this. The battlefields of today are very complex, and they have issues that go beyond just the security requirement. We should have learned that from Vietnam on. And so the military has felt very strongly that we need partners on the battlefield that work the political, the economic, the social conditions that take place. In many of the conflicts today, the military dimension is not enough in and of itself if it's resolved to settle the situation. It used to be you could handle these sorts of things sequentially, take care of the military business first, defeat the bad guys, you know, capture the capital, remove the regime, and then get on with reconstruction. Reconstruction begins now, just as the boots cross the line of departure. We do a great job, our military does, I think, in being able to handle their part of the action. It's the other parts that are far inadequate, and some of that has to do with funding and resources and organization. Some of it has to do with the culture. You have a military that, for example, are exceptional planners. I don't see that in the other dimensions. There's a question of scope and scale. Our military is capable of operating on a large scale, defeating national threats, coalition threats. I don't see we have the capacity to rebuild societies on that scale. Even going back to World War II, it was the military fundamentally in Japan and Germany that got saddled with this. The military becomes stuck with this problem of rebuilding. Look at what General Petraeus did in Iraq and elsewhere. It falls to the military. We see the failures of the civilian side. I think the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, its predecessor, the organization that was sent in, was way undermanned, did not have the competence, the manning level, the understanding of the culture, the history, the planning that would have had to go into reconstructing an Iraq or an Afghanistan. I don't see in the cultures of the State Department, USAID, and other institutions that they're able to handle that scope. They're able to do the detailed plans. What shocked me when I was a commander of CENTCOM, I was required to build war plans. I had them for places like Iraq. I certainly, when I was involved in Korea, I saw the Korean, obviously the Korean War plan. I don't see the counterpart plans for reconstructing of societies after a conflict. When we get engaged in at any level, whether it's a very low intensity or very high intensity, I don't see the planning and the effort going in. I tried, as the commander of CENTCOM, to engage these other organizations in doing this, and just did not find that they had the resources and, frankly, the will to engage and the background, the understanding. I was involved in a policy advisory group to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Lugar and then Senator Biden had co-chaired our group to look at what we needed to do to create this kind of a total organization when we got involved in these kinds of situations. And, you know, it was frustrating because nobody saw that you could change the bureaucracy. Wisely, I don't think the senators wanted to commit resources to something that wasn't going to materially improve the other side.
What are the characteristics of an effective leader? We will ask General Anthony Zinni, author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. Also joining us today from IBM is Frank Strickland. So, General, over the last decade, you just need to pick up a newspaper, and it's filled with stories of leadership failures across all sectors of society. What has happened to our leaders, and would you describe what has been called the epidemic of diseased leadership?
Yeah, I think we have a leadership crisis, and it's not just – when I began my last book, I researched to begin with what people feel about leadership. I was shocked to find that somewhere around 75% to 80% of American people think we have a crisis in leadership across the board in every element of our society. And it's not just the United States. Globally, we feel that way. I think that the conditions in the 21st century lead to that. It's a much more complex and complicated world. And so to be competent, you truly have to master not just a narrow field of capabilities, but a very broad field of capabilities. Our leaders are under much greater scrutiny than they ever have ever been before. Their world has been expanded and a spotlight thrown on it. The media, the public, the information, the knowledge is there. So you can't even make a move or a decision that isn't going to be open to criticism. And in many ways, that's good, obviously. In many ways, that really makes it difficult in terms of how leaders have to act. And just turn on a TV and see that every company has a CEO that has to be the face of the organization, has to communicate effectively, has to deal with crisis that every organization is going to handle. It's much more easy to have an organization fall into a period of crisis now. I think the demands from those we lead are greater now. They understand more what could be done because of the information technology, understanding of a better world. The demands are higher. Expectations are higher. Our workforces are much more diverse, and leading diverse workforces, leading diverse organizations has a lot of benefit, but it's much more difficult and it falls to the leader. So the stresses, the changes, the degree to which you have to be far more competent in so many different areas, understanding the speed that you have to operate in today and the environment that requires quick decisions, mastering information technology that has overwhelmed us and made the world much smaller and tighter and well-informed, all have impacted on leadership. And so there's a different kind of leader that has to come out now. And I think the old ways of leading won't be effective in this modern world.
So picking up on your book, Leading the Charge, you identify 11 core elements that a leader must have. I was interested in all 11. Could you highlight the key characteristics?
Yeah, and again, I kind of looked at leaders that were making it today, especially in fields that maybe most of the field was not successful. And I found that first of all, they understood the people they lead. Even though the diversity has grown, they manage to be able to touch every one of them. They listen well. They're approachable. They're interested in who the people are. They value the diversity. So they understand that this diversity doesn't come from just what you might think offhand, you know, ethnic, racial diversity, gender diversity. It also comes from a much longer-lived workforce. We have many more generations in the workforce than we had before. That's the result from health and obviously the necessity out of the economic conditions. But they're able to operate with a greater ability to touch all the people they're with. They understand themselves better. They're much more self-aware. They seek improvement. They seek coaching and mentoring. The successful leaders, they don't assume they get it. They're constantly learning. It's a thinking environment they create. They're critical thinkers. They're systems thinkers. They're creative thinkers. They make decisions based on analysis. They recognize patterns. It's recognitional decision makers. They become more instinctive based on their ability to analyze their experiences and educate themselves. They have a tremendous set of values. They understand the importance of ethics and moral behavior. And because of the scrutiny they're under, I think value-based institutions and leadership now are more successful. There's more demand for it now. They're strategic thinkers. They're visionaries. They look out beyond just the immediate future, the next quarter in business or the next year or two. They have a place they want to reach in a decade or two. They work the organization to that. They understand organization. They're willing to take risks. They'll change organizations. They adapt quicker. They streamline and flatten organizations. It's not the old, you know, tiered sort of Christmas tree block and wire diagram. They know that won't work. It's too ponderous. It's too slow. It isn't effective. It's hard to change. They appreciate technology, especially information technology. They understand that's where the future is. You have to master it, use it, keep up with how quickly it changes and improves. They understand the environment they're in. They understand that every aspect of society now has a broadened environment. They aren't what business calls tall, thin people. They don't just work in one narrow area. They constantly expand their field of knowledge, their basis for information, their understanding of the world as they become more senior and move up. They're effective communicators, both internally and externally. They can represent the organization. They can articulate who they are, what they are, what they want. And they work well in crisis and change. They can lead through crisis and they can lead through change. It's basically the effects are the same. And recognize the fact that in this day, this, you know, very difficult, complex set of times, that in this day and age, every organization will go through significant crisis or change.
Sir, you alluded earlier to leading through crises. What qualities mark leaders who successfully guide their enterprise through crises? And from your experiences, would you highlight some of those qualities or actions that have stood out?
Yeah, I think, I did some consulting work on helping understand how to lead through crisis. I've worked with some organizations that were going through crisis. You know, what's amazing is there's sort of tried and true principles to follow. I see organizations that invest a lot in understanding them either before a crisis or during, and then they violated every one of them. You recognize and understand reality. Don't be in denial. Accept it for what it is. If you try to put a rosy picture, look at what BP went through. In the beginnings, they were saying this is minor environmental damage. Get it all out right away. Don't try to. Bad news doesn't get better with age. And you can fool yourself. People want to tell you good news when there's more bad news, or they should be telling you. You have to encourage people to give you truth, face reality, get it out. Move quickly and decisively. Don't wait. Make the right moves. It's important for your people who are traumatized to be sympathetic with them, but not to commiserate. You know, I think we saw the CEO of BP say, I want my life back. No one wants to hear that from a leader. Sure, it's tough on you. I mean, I appreciate that. You have a family, you have a life, but that's not what a leader has to sacrifice and say, I have to worry about your life. Now, your life may be the customer. It may be those that have been harmed by the action of the organization. It may be internally. And you have to recognize that. You have to be creative. In crisis, when organizations come out of it, you always find someone you never expected that stepped up and either took charge or had a brilliant idea. I always use as a case study when I talk to people, it's something that I think all of us Marines know, is the old 1950s situation at Ribbon Creek in Parris Island. and how the Marine Corps, you know, stumbled in many ways in handling that, didn't understand the problem was greater than just a question of training and a training accident. It was beginning to question the whole socialization process of the Marine Corps. And despite all the leaders that were right up at the top, a relatively unknown leader, Wallace M. Green, popped to the top, made the right decisions, understood the problem, and led the Marine Corps through that. He was a relatively obscure brigadier, went on to become the commandant of the Marine Corps. And I think many ways that was truly highlighted who he was. You need to help your people get through this. I think you need to do a gut check on yourself. You can't compromise your standards and values on this. Don't attempt to hide anything or take a shortcut. You got to lead through your brain, not through your heart, your emotion. You've got to drive the process. Be the face of the organization. Be out front. Be the one that's seen. Take the heat if necessary. Get the whole organization committed and involved to it. And look at restructuring the organization to deal with this. Sometimes the organization and the way it's structured can't handle it. You might have to create a team to really work on this, a team of quality people, and make sure it doesn't destroy you personally in the process, too. Sometimes that's hard, but you know, you sort of have to keep that face up. You have to tell your people that there are challenges that come from this crisis, but maybe there's opportunities, too, opportunity to be better and come out of this better. I can't think of one organization I have ever been part of that didn't face a crisis at one point or another and had to get through it, and some handled it better than others.
Well, General, this is a nice segue into how does one lead across sectors, boundaries, and generations to bring people together and meet mission? But more particularly, would you elaborate on the role of the led in the discussion of successful leadership?
I think you have to engage the led. You know, leadership, I think the false belief that leadership is a top-down process, leadership starts at the top and goes down, is a mistake. I quote in the book a friend of mine who was a very experienced diplomat, since passed away, but he once told me, you know, the chain of command or the leadership structure is like a tree full of monkeys. When you look from the top down, it's all smiling faces. You look at from the bottom up, you get a different perspective. You know, I like the idea that you create a culture of leadership, that leadership can come from the top down, bottom up, from the left to the right or the right to the left, that there's a sense that we all lead. I mean, obviously, in the process of accountability and responsibility, there is a definite path. But I think that you trust people, you delegate more, you involve them more in understanding the decisions that have to be made, you invite them to participate in the decision, participatory decision making. They have a voice. First of all, the more voices and the greater diversity, the lead that you bring into this, I think the more views you get, the more options you get, the more understanding you get. But secondly, they feel like, you know, I've had a say in this, you know, whether they bought my advice or not. I was allowed to participate in this. Allowing people to make mistakes, trusting their leadership, subordinate leaders' leadership, I think becomes key. They feel invested in the organization, part of it, trusting. So I like it when organizations sort of identify themselves as not just the leadership from a top-down or a management level or a senior officer position, but they describe that we are a leader organization. Every leader, regardless of what position they have, every member of the organization has a leadership role, has an involvement in leadership decisions to some degree or another. Those organizations are much more healthy.
How do you balance the right mix of hard and soft power? We will ask General Anthony Zinni, author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How is the federal government leveraging award prizes to spur innovation and solve tough problems? Pick up the latest Center report, Managing Innovation Prizes in Government, and find out. Drawing on such successful efforts like the Lunar Lander Challenge and DARPA's Grand Urban Challenges, this report offers practical insights and recommendations for the design, implementation, and evaluation of innovation prizes in government. You can order or download a free copy of Managing Innovation Prizes in Government and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Telework has been touted as a winning strategy for government. In fact, a study by the Telework Research Network claims potential savings of nearly $3.8 billion. In a recent IBM Center report, Implementing Telework, Lessons Learned for Four Federal Agencies, Professor Scott Obermeyer presents case studies of federal agencies who have successfully implemented telework in their organizations. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. Also joining us today from IBM is Frank Strickland. So, General Zinni, how do you balance the right mix of hard and soft power when confronted with the global challenges facing the nation today?
I don't think there's a sort of a percentage mix. I think each situation is differently. Some situations, the security or hard power requirement is minimal. Some cases, it's dominant and maybe has to have more investment, maybe certainly in the initial stages. But it's clear that hard and soft power, unlike the past, has to be married pre-conflict. You need to have an organization that's trained, equipped, plans for, understands how to have an integrated team approach on the battlefield. And you're beginning to see some elements of this, and again, led by the military. The U.S. Southern Command, Admiral Stavridis when he was down there, the Africa Command, you see their staffs that are more integrated. They don't just reflect military requirements. In some cases, you actually have, I know in the case of African Command, their deputy was a State Department former ambassador. And you're beginning to see that kind of integration. Again, there is no formula for the mix. It should be flexible. Maybe security plays a 10% role. Maybe it plays a 90% role. Maybe it goes from 90 to 10 in the course. I think clearly, again, it has to be integrated from the beginning. There's a degree of planning and preparation and pre-conflict integration that has to take place and understanding. We need to build better systems. I always used to argue that if I had a counterpart in State Department, if it was the regional assistant secretaries, we should be co-located. And that we should work together. Not that they come under military command, certainly wouldn't be in favor of that, but we should co-locate, we should co-plan, we should co-analyze our regions. Even the structure is wrong. The world as it's divided up in the world of State Department and the world of Department of Defense are different. Our regions are different. When I was a CENTCOM commander, I had to work with four assistant secretaries with overlapping or underlapping regions, and that's very confusing. And it could change policy. I mean, I had, largely the Middle East, but I didn't have Israel. That can drive a lot of policy decisions that affect the rest of the elements of power. But from my perspective, it did, but it was sort of external. It was in the area of interest, not really in the area of influence I had. And so that can be problematic in the way you deal with it. So we also ought to look at structuring. We ought to look at cooperation. We ought to look at more integration at the lowest levels. And again, planning is critical. The military are crazy planners. We plan everything as much as we can in detail. I got to say, and I guess others can argue with it, I don't see the same level at the other agencies and departments.
So the U.S. can't do everything. And in that mind, I'd like to get your insights into how you choose priorities to act. And what are the limits of power, influence, and leadership for the U.S.?
Well, I think we're learning that we have greater limitations now. We've come from a sort of a heady time when we emerged from World War II as the most dominant power in the world. And have learned now that maybe it's not so much that we have been on the decline, it's others that have been on the rise. I don't believe it's a zero-sum game. That's good news in many ways. There's more partners out there. There's more burden sharing. So I think that what the U.S. has to understand is it's not so much what you can do yourself, but it's what you can create in terms of international and regional cooperation to share the burden and the work together. Now we always talk about American leadership. Sometimes it's American leadership, sometimes it's not. Look at East Timor, the Australians led, and we support it. I think we're trying to do that in Libya in many ways, or let NATO lead. I think we need to do far greater work in building international and regional cooperation and entities that could deal with this. When I had part of Africa as part of Central Command, I always felt that we didn't pay enough attention. Here was a continent that really tried to organize itself regionally and sub-regionally. The African Union, ECOWAS, ECOMOG, SADC, the EAC. I mean, all these organizations that are created to try to deal with security issues, economic issues, political issues, they lacked resources, training, education, and experience in these areas. And I didn't see, again, the developed world helping them with this. Everybody waited until it was a complete disaster. The developed world threw boots on the ground to answer the problem, then regretted it and complained about it. When I saw these organizations saying, help us put it together, we need resources, we need the training, we need the education, the investment, but we want to handle our own problems. I think there needs to be more of that. I think we ought to reassess our relationships. I'm not so happy with the performance in NATO, in Afghanistan or Libya. You know, it's 28 nations with maybe a handful that really, truly participate. It's become dysfunctional. And I know that's sort of something that people don't want to hear, but we need to reassess relationships like that, maybe build new coalitions. And we need to understand what they are. Are they political relationships? Are they military alliances? You know, what do they do? It's important for us to make sure they're viable for the 21st century and not relics of the Cold War or post-World War II era.
General Zinni, it's been 25 years since the Goldwater-Nichols Act reworked the command structure of the United States military. What do you like about the Goldwater-Nichols-Nunn-Cohen model, and what further enhancements are needed to meet the demands of the day? What more needs to be done?
I think the brilliance of Goldwater-Nichols is the fact that the integrating element was not set up as a separate bureaucracy. What I mean by that, you know, when I was a young major at our headquarters, I worked on Goldwater-Nichols, and I remember the only thing we cooperated with the other services was to kill Goldwater-Nichols. And as a young major, I couldn't quite understand why. And I remember my chief of service telling me, you know, the big fear was like all government solutions to integration problems are going to create what he called a class of mandarins, a separate, you know, look how the intelligence community created the DNI's office. Look how Homeland Security was created. Most of the times when reform is needed and integration is the problem, as we saw in the intelligence problems post 9/11 and Homeland Security, the answer is to integration is create another structure, add more bureaucracy, add more tiers, and that becomes dysfunctional in the end. What Goldwater-Nichols said to the services, we're not going to create a separate, the joint structure will be manned from the services. You will man it, and you will man it with people that won't come from the outside, but from the inside. You will serve tours in the joint world. We demand quality. It's going to be a requirement for promotion. You will have components represent you in each of the joint structures, senior componency. So by you manning the organization and those people returning to your service, by you having senior-level components that are the substantive elements of it, you have representation, you have a voice, and you have a say in the decision-making. And so what happens is the leery services that once had to do this suddenly realize, well, look, you know, the joint command, who is CENTCOM, for example? Well, the commander's a Marine, you know, and may return or go into something else, but came from the Marine Corps. The deputy is from the Army, you know, the director of operations is from the Air Force or whatever, and it maneuvers around. You get different services. There is a component. There is a senior general or flag officer over a staff structure that represents component interests. Those component interests, meaning service interests, are represented in the command at a very senior level. How you employ those forces, how you best present their capabilities, how you work toward helping the commander integrate them are all coming. So it was built from whole cloth. And so what I think happened, I watched this from the mid-80s, Goldwater-Nichols was passed, so I left the service in 2000. I saw us go through three phases. I would describe the first phase as deconfliction. All right, we got to do this. It's law. Let's stay out of each other's way. Let's find a way to deconflict on the battlefield or whatever we do. We'll agree to disagree in places. We'll carve our own path, and you know, but we'll sort of reluctantly and begrudgingly look at each other, and so we went through the deconfliction phase, and it was a very defensive era. I mean, Marines worried about somebody stealing their air, and you know, we went through all sorts of issues. Each service becoming very parochial and very concerned, very paranoid to a large extent. All of a sudden, as we began to work through this, we found, you know, these are Americans over there, and we all are trying to do the same thing. We have our service issues, but we're beginning to find some of the service issues we thought were issues you could actually resolve. So we moved into the second phase, which I think really began maybe in the early 90s, which I would call the coordination phase. We actually found, let's not just deconflict. We could actually work together. And the synergy, you know, that came from that, the efficiencies and effectiveness could be great. And then I think by the time I left, I saw true integration. And where I think I saw true integration is when we were making decisions in the joint world, we didn't look at uniforms anymore. We didn't think in terms of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Special Operations. We thought we were thinking in terms of capabilities. Look, for this mission, this is the capability I need. You looked at options, you know, who could provide it. You were willing to take those options if they were service options and actually integrate them further. So I think we've arrived at true integration. I think it's a good model, again, for the other agencies of government or the interagency process.
Well, over the past decade or more, we've seen those joint forces increasingly used to perform humanitarian, peacekeeping, and disaster relief operations. From your perspective, is the military well-structured now and equipped for such operations, or what could be done to improve our capabilities there?
No, in terms of training and equipping and organizing, it's a zero-sum game. I mean, you can't optimize for everything. We can't afford it, first of all. I mean, I remember when the discussion was maybe in the early 80s or early 90s, well, maybe we should have a bifurcated military, one that sort of handles these kinds of missions, another that's more tuned for the conventional or larger scale operations. We can't afford it. I think what we have to do, it's always a question of optimizing or hedging. You know, where do you take risks? Obviously, you're going to try to take fewer risks at a level that presents a more existential threat to you. So, you know, you've got to leverage the technology, invest in modernization in areas where you don't want to lose an edge, or you want to maintain a significant edge, where if you don't, it could become significant and a potential threat can create a greater capability that makes it more dangerous to miscalculate or misadventure into something disastrous. At this level that we're talking about here, these kinds of missions are where we're going to hedge. We should be honest about that. So you may say, I can't afford maybe a lot of training in that, you know, but I can invest maybe more in education and understanding, which is a little less resource intensive. We did this when I was at 1st Marine Expeditionary Force. We ran a series of, we called them exercises, but they were really seminars and discussions called Emerald Express. We had a number of commitments and missions that would drive us toward peacekeeping, humanitarian, and other missions specifically designated for us by some of the combatant commanders. And I didn't need to put a Marine team out there on an exercise on a reverse osmosis water purification unit, because he's going to do the same thing, whether it's conventional warfare or low-intensity warfare or whatever we call it now. So I didn't need him out there to do it. Basically, these kinds of missions need the education of senior leaders, enlisted and officer, better understanding. I thought the training was more efficient and effective to spend a week or two a year bringing in non-governmental organization people, State Department people, United Nations people, coalition partners from around the world that face these sorts of things in Africa and Central America and elsewhere, and to educate the leaders what had to be done. And so I think there are smarter ways you can minimize risk, you can hedge, and you can understand the resource impacts. And that's where I think you got to deal at this level primarily. I don't think you can afford two services. There just isn't enough time. You can't draw away from certain kinds of training and education and preparation and planning requirements because they deal with existential threats when these may not be, more often than not.
What does the future hold for advancing the use of smart power in the battle for peace? We will ask General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The Open Government Directive called upon each federal agency to formulate a plan for how it intended to increase openness and public engagement in its programs and operations. The latest Senate report, An Open Government Implementation Model, Moving to Increase Public Engagement, provides a roadmap federal agencies can use to guide their efforts. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Senate report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. The U.S. workplace is undergoing a significant transition that presents uncharted territory and tremendous opportunity. The latest Senate report, Engaging a Multi-Generational Workforce, Practical Advice for Government Managers, examines six trends now occurring in the workplace and describes how leaders can successfully manage through these trends and their challenges. These are the challenges of leading a multi-generational workforce and is increasingly driven by rapid technological changes that have changed the nature of work and how it gets done. You can order or download a free copy of this report and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. Also joining us today from IBM is Frank Strickland. General, I'd like to transition to some of the insights in your book, The Battle for Peace. You point out that true peace is not passive. It's actually a presence and an action. Would you elaborate on that insight?
Yeah, I think people fool themselves into thinking peace is the absence of violence. It may not be. I mean, when we talked earlier about the stages of instability, you could have simmering problems where you could see you were headed toward violence. And you have to work at peace. It's easy for us to not appreciate that because we're from a highly developed society. You know, we take a lot of things for granted. We take stability for granted. We take maybe for granted the durability and sustainability of a civilized approach to everything. But if you've walked the streets of Mogadishu or Port-au-Prince, which I have, you realize how fragile it can be. And given that those were maybe not the most highly developed nations in the world, they were still societies that after this period of time you would think, you know, could not dissolve into a Mad Max movie scene. But they can. And we should always realize that we should not take those things for granted. The institutions which preserve and promote peace have to be kept healthy and viable. Security institutions, the political institutions that allow for representation and voice, the economic systems and institutions that provide for our well-being, the social institutions which care for all elements of our society, give a sense of fairness and treatment and are constantly reexamining ourselves. America's greatest strength is that we always reassess our institutions. I think we have looked throughout history where, you know, we had a constitution that made all men equal. Almost 250 years later, we're still looking at how we could do that better. I mean, the civil rights movement showed that just those words in the Constitution weren't enough. Gender equality, many of these things have evolved to a most fair basis in latter times as opposed to earlier times. Although the statements and the commitments were made, it was an ongoing process to truly achieve what we meant by that and how it's going to manifest itself. And I think that one of the things that make us great, if not the most significant thing, is this self-examination, self-criticism, need to constantly reassess. I think the whole concept of the Supreme Court and its look at constitutional issues is this ability to constantly reassess our who we are and what we are, what we stand for, against the statement of what we are, the concept, the ideal, which is a constitution, which is more than a law. The fact that we make all our government officials, service members swear an oath to it, it's not to an individual, it's not to a structure, it's to an ideal, it's to a concept of what we're all about, our very essence, and our ability to say our reach should exceed our grasp, and we should constantly be trying to make our society better. If we ever lose that, then I think we're in trouble. As de Tocqueville said, America is good. If America ever stops being good, it will fail. You know, and so basically, you've got to try to seek the ultimate good, the ultimate truth, the ultimate, you know, concept of what you're all about. That's what peace is about. Peace and the ability to develop a society that works for the benefit of all its members to the ultimate degree, allows for its expression and development. You know, it's hard to do because there are decisions you make for the society as a whole, for the individual. So it's a, you know, as we learn more, as we understand more, as science gives us more, becomes more complex. And that is a continuous struggle. So, you know, the term of the book is the battle for peace, which you could say is the struggle for peace. The struggle really doesn't end. You know, we are a constantly evolving species. And as we evolve and learn and understand more, we're going to confuse ourselves and it's going to become much more complex and we're going to have to make adjustments. We should be trying to make those for greater good as we go along. It's too easy to drift back. And I think that's why I say peace is a continuous struggle and is a continuous battle.
Let's return briefly to the topic of intelligence. In this ongoing struggle for peace, intelligence plays an important role in understanding the uncertain world as it is evolving. What are some of the changes that you see that need to be made to intelligence in order to better equip it to provide that service?
Well, I think that there's not a lack of capability in our intelligence community. We certainly have enough organizations within it. I would say there's a lack of integration of those organizations. There's a lot of parochialism, which I think people in the business understand and see every day. The ability to integrate it has been a failure. I mean, we're on our fifth DNI, Director of National Intelligence now, over six plus years, which is confusing. We're still debating, you know, who has authority over people and resources and all that. There's sort of mission conflict or roles conflict, which you can see. So I think the first problem is one of true integration, true understanding. I don't think there's anybody in Washington that really understands the totality of the intel community and what all its component parts are, where they are, and what they do. I don't think we understand the resources put toward it, you know, whether it's insufficient or sufficient. I don't think we even have a handle on that. I may be overly critical. I don't know. I just don't know. I think we have to be honest about how our intelligence in many ways has failed us in recent times. I think Iraq is a good example. I think some of the, you know, there are many things that happened that maybe should have been predicted that weren't predicted. You know, and I think Iraq, 9/11, we can go through the litany of problems and issues that the intel community could see. I think there are certain things that I sympathize with the intel community. I think the ones that we all know, the destruction basically of our human capability, lack of investment, the legal issues that go with that, many ways that have created problems. I think during the Cold War, we developed an over-reliance on order of battle kind of intelligence. Sort of, we became very mechanistic in the way we looked at things, and then it was harder for us to understand intent or to read it. You know, so I do think we have a long way to go in developing the kind of intelligence capability that's very usable. Now, having said that, let me defend the intel community in a certain respect. I think the people who make decisions, operational and strategic decisions, do not understand how to ask the questions. In other words, how to use intelligence and how to integrate intelligence into the decision making. Intelligence is not just the provision of information. Those that analyze and develop have to be part of the decision making process. Like I said before, they have to understand what you're trying to do, what your intent is, what you need. And if you just get the question, I often think to myself, I don't know how the question was asked of, say, Director Tenet by the president on the work up to Iraq. And I always imagine that what would have been the answer had the president said, George, I'm going to go to war and I'm going to base it on weapons of mass destruction. Can you assure me that this is a justification for war? Not that convince me you're going to find something and it's a slam dunk, that it's a justification for war. In other words, there's a big difference in that. The president is trying to justify a war that I think he had other reasons, my opinion for doing it, I think strategic reasons. But if he's going to pin that everything on that, then that director of Central Intelligence, his obligation is to say, I can guarantee you this will warrant justification, or I can't. And so if you make that decision, it can't rest here. That's what I mean by involving the provider of intelligence with the intent and the level of decision-making, as opposed to just saying, we're going to war, you know, I'm going to use WMD as an excuse, you know, can I find, you know, five chemical weapons somewhere that are rusted and I can justify? To me, that's what would worry me. The intelligence system needs to stop being a top-down organization. If you go back and do the forensics on 9/11, there was enough out there to know something was up. And so we have to say, why didn't the bottom-up system work? Why didn't the flags go off? Why didn't it, you know? And I know the answer to that is always create a fusion organization somewhere. You know, we'll create another. Like I said, the answer to everything is more bureaucracy and organization. That's not the answer. That FBI agent that smelled something tried to report it and she didn't get any attention. You know, the guy that was running an aircraft training organization that didn't have a means. It may be more process or mechanics or philosophy that's involved. And the intelligence community needs to look at that, too. I always am critical and suspect of things that you have a problem and the solution is just organizational, as opposed to maybe cultural, philosophical process, which I think are important ways to look at things. So that's what I think can happen. I am not sure we analyze against intentions. We analyze against highly specific questions and requirements. And that, I think, is the biggest mistake we make. I was asked by Director Tenet one time, I wrote about this in my book. He wanted to come down to U.S. Central Command, and he called me up and he said,